Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kurupko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have the Chinese and Vietnamese foreign ministers agreeing to settle their South China Sea dispute through talks. The announcement was made in Hanoi and would be a welcome move if implemented in a region beset by American-provoked division over this issue. But therein lays the catch, and it's that talking about a peaceful resolution to this contentious topic is a lot easier than actually reaching one. Both parties see the issue in terms of national pride and strategic security because of the global attention that this dispute has generated and the significance in staking out sovereign claims over the energy-rich waterway through which trillions of dollars worth of trade traverses each year. Neither side is interested in going to war over their claims, though they've nevertheless built up their naval forces regardless, owing to the security dilemma that's developed between them over the years. That's why Vietnam has diversified its military portfolio to include not only super quiet diesel subs from Russia, but also a few small surface ships from the US as a symbolic sign of ever-developing cooperation through the so-called Quad. There are also persistent rumors that it's in secret talks to acquire state-of-the-art supersonic BrahMos missiles that are jointly developed by Russia and India. Hanoi, for deep-seated historical reasons dating back to a nearly millennial-long domination by China almost 2,000 years ago, strongly distrusts Beijing and is clearly building up its naval deterrence capabilities in order to safeguard its claims and push for the best deal possible, a state of affairs that the U.S. has continually tried to exploit. Should the cold peace between these two trade partners hold, then there's already a model in place that they could follow in peacefully resolving their dispute. Russia and NATO member Norway used to be embroiled in a similar dispute in the Barents Sea, but reached a simple deal with one another in 2010 to evenly divide the territory and jointly develop the energy resources located along their new maritime border. This win-win solution could easily be replicated all across the South China Sea, so long as each party has the political will to do so. So, in this Southeast Asian theater, ancillary demilitarization and anti-piracy collective security clauses might have to be included in the final agreement in order to assuage all the countries involved that none of them will try to one-up the other afterwards. This is, of course, the ideal scenario, but it's probably still a far ways off and will likely see the U.S. intensely trying to offset it in the meantime. The next one up is Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman acknowledging that Syrian President Assad will more than likely remain in office. He said this groundbreaking remark during an interview with Time magazine, at which time he also expressed his hopes that President Assad would decrease his strategic dependence on Iran. The first part of this announcement represents a pragmatic geopolitical admission that aligns with his ambitious reform agenda at home in rolling back Wahhabism, to which end he also told the Washington Post in an earlier interview that this ideology's global proselytization was pushed by the West in the late Cold War era to counter the USSR. While the second part could have been expected, given that Saudi Arabia's leading role in the hybrid war of terror on Syria was always about containing Iran. About that, Hezbollah Secretary General Nasrallah recently informed the world of a secret meeting between high-ranking Saudi and Syrian officials where Riyadh supposedly offered Damascus billions of dollars of reconstruction aid in exchange for cutting ties with Tehran, though the Arab Republic supposedly refused. Still, MBS's friendly follow-up remark about recognizing that President Assad will remain in office could be read as Riyadh tacitly asking Damascus to reconsider this offer due to the strategic situation in the country and the regional balance of forces in general. The U.S. and its Israeli and Saudi lead-from-behind allies will do everything in their power to prevent a so-called Iranian land bridge to Lebanon via Syria, whether real or imagined, while Syria and Iran don't have the conventional, keyword, military capabilities to counter this. Moreover, Russia and Turkey have signaled that they'll passively accept whatever happens and won't get involved in the simmering conflict. Hence why Moscow regularly allows Tel Aviv to bomb Syria as long as it says that it's doing so in order to counter Iran or Hezbollah. The conflict will therefore continue to drag on unless something serious changes, which is why MBS may have offered President Assad a breakthrough deal, such as the one that he gave to former Yemeni President Saleh to switch sides. And his reaffirmation of the Syrian leader's democratic right to remain in office may have been Riyadh's way of asking Damascus to reconsider its previous refusal. Third on a countdown is France dispatching troops to northern Syria in support of the Kurds. President Macron announced Paris's unprecedented decision after meeting with Kurdish leaders in the French capital last week, a move that was summarily denounced by Ankara as crossing the line and amounting to the Western European country supporting terrorism through what Turkey would ironically consider to be an invasion of Syria. Intra-NATO conflicts are reaching a boiling point as the US, Greece, and now France all align themselves against Turkey's regional interest in response to Ankara's post-coup embrace of multipolarity, which has put tremendous pressure on President Erdogan to walk back his developing pivot or dangerously face the consequences. The Turkish leader has refused to back down and is now forced to confront the prospects of joint American-French support of what his government considers to be Kurdish terrorists, which will only deepen his desire to intensify his country's strategic redirection eastward. Not only that, but Turkey might asymmetrically counter France's unfriendly military deployment through pro-Ankara proxy forces in northern Syria. Turkish media leaked the location of each place that France's forces will supposedly be deployed to, just like they did to the Americans last summer, which can be read as a tacit threat that both countries' troops might now be targeted by armed groups sympathetic to Turkey in the incipient Rojava civil war that's unfolding in northern Syria. France's plan to assist the U.S. in this battle space, and potentially even replace it to a degree if Trump goes through on his intentions to withdraw from the country very soon, might inevitably lead to Paris getting caught in a second Malian-like quagmire. Albeit this time, it would be fighting against actual rebels in what has now become a multi-sided civil war within a civil war and not against terrorists. The fast-moving developments go to show that the old model of colonialism no longer works in post-colonial societies where former colonizers sought to exploit minority groups against the majority. The people of northeastern Syria will not allow their actual former colonizer to return to the country and use pro-Western Kurds as their proxy tool for suppressing the Arab majority. Furthermore, Turkey is cooperating with Russia via the Astana peace process and will likely reach an eventual compromise to at the very least nominally return the territories that its allied rebel groups control to the authority of the Syrian government, though probably after securing its geopolitical interest through the forthcoming UNSC-mandated constitutional revision that will probably lead to a degree of decentralization. France, however, has no such intentions in doing the same vis-a-vis its proxies and Russia, so it represents a much more dire threat to Syrian sovereignty than Turkey does at this moment. Our runner-up is former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine during Euromaidan and present chief diplomat in Greece, Jeffrey Pyatt, predicting that Turkey's ties with both the U.S. and Greece will go through what he described as turbulence ahead of President Erdogan's re-election vote next year. This ambiguous warning can be interpreted in one of two ways. The decontextualized understanding is to think that he's hinting that President Erdogan will cynically stage various highly publicized provocations against them in order to galvanize the electorate and appeal to nationalists, while an informed reading would be that the U.S. plans to use Greece as a hybrid war destabilization tool against Turkey during this sensitive time, while hiding behind the plausible deniability of the mainstream media's messaging that President Erdogan is really to blame. The second interpretation is probably the most accurate, because Pyatt has proven himself to be a false flag and perception management master after his success during Euromaidan, so his words shouldn't ever be taken at their face value or in good faith. That said, there are plenty of pre-existing problems between Greece and Turkey, and all that the U.S. has to do is subtly manipulate this tense situation so that each party engages in a self-sustaining cycle of escalation in order to promote what they believe to be their own interest. This strategy aligns with the classic third-party intelligence goal of scenario superiority, or provoking mutually disastrous divide-and-rule conflicts like what the U.S. has a track record of doing with the Iran-Iraq War and the Soviet-Afghan One, for example. The incentivizing catalyst in this case could easily be access to energy resources, such as the ones that are disputed between Turkish-controlled northern Cyprus and the rest of pro-Greek rump Cyprus. Any exacerbation of this frozen conflict could provoke a third intra-NATO crisis with Turkey, such as the ones that the U.S. and France already have with Ankara over their support of Kurdish militants in northern Syria, thus furthering Ankara's fears that it's being strategically encircled by its former allies as punishment for its developing post-coup multipolar pivot. In addition, worsening Turkish-Greek tensions could have profound energy consequences for Europe too. The Trans-Adriatic pipeline being built from Azerbaijan to Italy across Turkey, Greece, and Albania could potentially have its supplies disrupted if Ankara decides to wield energy as an instrument of pressure in this dispute, thus making its competitor project of the Turkish Balkan Stream much more attractive by comparison because of its possible Bulgarian route. Any serious speculation over Turkey's reliability as TAP's transit state to the EU through Greece could be taken advantage of by the US in order to sell its relatively costlier LNG to the bloc instead. Likewise, Turkish Balkan Stream would have to forego any prospective plans for transiting through Greece and instead be forced to use Bulgaria as its entry point to the EU, once again making the Balkan state a pivotal energy player and returning the strategic situation back to its South Stream days when Sofia commanded an irreplaceable role in facilitating the Russian-EU energy trade. Conclusively, when bearing in mind these interconnected strategic factors, Piatt's warning can be interpreted more as a threat in conveying America's intentions to provoke another Greek-Turkish crisis in order to return Russia to its erstwhile pipeline transit dependence on pro-American Bulgaria and improve the appeal of costly U.S. LNG exports to Europe. At our top spot, we've got China responding to Trump's tariffs with economic restrictions of its own. China's market has always been notoriously difficult to enter due to Beijing's own, ironically, protectionist policies designed to safeguard its domestic producers. Though the government has been easing its prior regulations in recent years in order to facilitate the country's One Belt, One Road global vision of new Silk Road connectivity, the developing trade war between the U.S. and China threatens to formalize the long-running economic competition between these two great powers as they vie with one another over control of the world order. With Washington wanting to retain its erstwhile but fading unipolar dominance, while Beijing wants to pioneer the emergence of a multipolar system marked by a diversity of theoretically equal stakeholders. The friction between these contradictory forces is the basis of the ongoing new Cold War, though there's a bit more of a backstory to this global struggle than just that. The U.S. thought that winning back Beijing through its late Cold War-era alliance with China against the USSR would allow Washington to do as it pleases to what its decision-makers had convinced themselves was their largest proxy state to date. But the U.S.'s betrayal of China through the failed Tiananmen Square color revolution attempt of 1989 forever changed how the East Asian country's communist leaders viewed America. Nevertheless, the naive, liberal globalists of the Clinton era thought that they could bribe China to remain loyal to the U.S.-led global world order that emerged after the Cold War by relying on win-win investments that would enrich the American elite while helping China rapidly modernize. Suffice to say, this presumption proved to be totally false. The so-called Washington Consensus and attendant rules of the game are rigged in order to benefit the U.S. and indefinitely perpetuate its global hegemony, which is why China continuously broke the rules to its advantage, but was allowed to get away with it for so long because of the aforementioned relationship that it had with naive, liberal globalist American elites who profited from this system at the expense of average Americans. the Obama administration tried to preemptively balance the inevitable geopolitical consequences of this trend by proposing the so-called Group of Two, or Chimerica, global partnership with China, but Beijing rejected this outreach. By 2013, China felt confident enough with its newfound strength to announce the world-changing Obor megaproject that's designed to bring a definitive end to America's economic dominance and related unipolar leadership. But then the U.S. and China suddenly switched global economic roles following Trump's election. President Xi's January 2017 speech at Davos saw him proclaim China as the champion of a reformed version of the globalization model that America once led. While President Trump has made no secret of his preference for the type of protectionist, nationalist policies that the People's Republic itself embraced in the past, the rest of the world is now compelled to choose between these competing systems. Just like during the old Cold War, however, the new one is seeing the reemergence of another non-aligned movement, the Neo-Nam, that's attempting to strike a middle ground by hybridizing the best policies of both, but in a more complicated and comprehensive way than before, because of the inextricable geopolitical and economic dimensions that transcend the former dogmatic adherence to a single ideology. If there's any ideology at all nowadays, then it's the pure self-interest of neorealism. And it's here where Russia can play a pivotal role during this transitional period of global systemic change by assisting the Neo-Nam in balancing between both blocs and reaping the resultant advantages. All right, folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown. And as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice weekend and tune in again next week. Thanks. Bye.